to page 739 in the Bibles that you have there on your seats. And what we're looking at together this morning is just the one verse from Isaiah 52. We're going to look at verse 7. I've got to kind of confess, I was given a bigger passage to look at this morning, 7 through till 10. But as I prepared and as I guess I put the time into looking at the passage to get ready for this morning, I just didn't get past verse 7 because it's so good. And well, I reckon there's a number of sermons in the one verse alone. I got stuck there, but I think that's a good thing. And considering how the Lord has been speaking and leading us as we've come to the building this morning, and even just the sense of the Lord's presence as we've worshipped and met together, it's just great, and I'm excited. When you speak, it's always kind of it's always great when you have that sense of just kind of like just complimenting the great things that God has already done this morning. So I kind of feel like I can't lose. Well, you might disagree at the end of this, but I'm going to have fun. And so the title that John gave me, I wonder if he's got this kind of little secret thing going on. Beautiful Feet. That is an interesting title for a sermon. But as I found out, very relevant. Okay, so let's look together. Isaiah 52, verse 7. I'm reading for the from the NIV 2. So, how beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, and who say to Zion, your God reigns. I'll read it one more time. We've got lots of time in our hands. Isaiah 52, verse 7. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, and who say to Zion, your God reigns. So what I want to do is just to take a closer look at this. I just want to break it up into three sections. And have you got my picture up there yet? It was remarkable. You go onto the internet and you type in, you know, certain things to look for, maybe some commentary or something that's not in the kind of like the run-of-the-mill websites. The amount of people in God's earth that have actually taken pictures of their feet and put them on the internet, there was thousands, absolutely thousands. Now, you might think that's weird, and it's even sadder that someone like me is on the internet looking at pictures of people's feet. I don't know which is weirder. I don't know which is sadder, but I couldn't believe it. I mean, anyway, we've only just had broadband, so I'm kind of just experimenting and kind of finding the internet out, you know. And you just type in the words, you know, how lovely are the feet, or how lovely on the mountains are the feet of those. And you come up with all these, just the strangest things people do with their feet and then take pictures of it. Anyway, I'm not going to be using any analogies from that, don't worry about it. I guess the first section I wanted just to kind of look at is our first line. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news. Now, I mean, this is one of those quite familiar passages. I've read this passage, I don't know about you, but I've read it quite a bit. And I've heard it read aloud in church quite a bit, and I've heard one or two sermons on it. But the thing is that I've never given much attention or thought to the fact that it's feet. It's the image of feet that God chooses to, you know, make relevant or apply here. It's not the armpit. It's got Anna's attention. That's good. It's not the arm. It's not the elbow. It's not the knee. It's not the ear. God chooses to use the image and the word of feet as he speaks to the prophet Isaiah here. And there's two reasons I think that's relevant. Firstly, I think the image that we're given here in the word feet, it's a very human one. There's nothing deeply or profoundly theological about that. It's just a very human image. You all have them. young and old, male and female. So when we go there and we read, this image that comes through to the prophet is one everyone can relate to. We all have feet. It's just simple. It's just that simple. And I guess really what I wanted to start by saying is that the challenge I think God is making to us this morning, in a broader sense through this season, but in specific through the text we're looking at this morning, what I think God is saying is that, you know, he's reminding us the simplicity of this call. That all you need to do is have feet to qualify. I'm going to spend a little bit more time on that in a minute, but so often we set people apart from ourselves, and we think one gift is better than the other, one gift is more relevant than the other, and sometimes what I know I do, you don't have to nod or kind of agree, you know, so you're caught out. But, you know, we do that. We think that, oh, that's not for me, or, you know, I couldn't do that, or we just disqualify ourselves constantly. Because we think they're for certain types of people. We make assumptions on people that are bold enough and take the risk to get up and share a word like Mary. It's fun. I've known Mary for a long time. You don't find that easy, Mary, do you? But you just want to be obedient, don't you? The call to bring the good news, which this passage is about, it's for everyone. Everyone can do it. All you need is feet. Secondly, moving on, I think it's impossible to speak about feet and not consider the whole concept of motion. It's how feet are what we use to get from A to B. Even if we're going somewhere in a car, we have to walk to our car. I was just on holiday in New York a couple of weeks ago. I had to walk to the, you know, from the car to the plane, down onto the cat, you know, the runway, up onto the plane. I had to walk to my seat when we got to Shannon to get out again. Don't get me started. To go through and be accosted by an American customs person, no problem. But here in the book of Isaiah we find hints and echoes where the Spirit is speaking what Jesus would articulate further in the Gospel of Matthew as he gathers those around him and he says, you know, go. And just like Andrew referred to it earlier on, there's a passage that's meant a lot to us over the past year from the book of John, chapter 15. And there in verse 16 it says, you know, you haven't chosen me, I've chosen you, and I've appointed you to go. Then it goes on to the familiarity of that, and you know, well, you've appointed us to go, to bear much fruit that will last. But often I've read through that passage and I've missed that. I've appointed you to go. It's exciting. And I just think, I was thinking about this morning when I was preparing how to start. And I was thinking, it's kind of like, you know, when you're at an airport and you're waiting for your own flight. And on the intercom it comes over, can such and such a person and such and such a person and such and such a person, your flight is fully boarded, and you know, you hear the same message over and over and over and over again. It's like a pregnant, like they're all waiting to go somewhere and some dude is up, you know, buying his whiskey and duty free. You say, what? Oh me? No, oh chill. I've been there and done that. And I just kind of felt it's like that. It's almost like this call to bring the good news, this charge to us to live our lives in such a way that they reflect what we say, what we claim we believe. That charge, it's just not going away. It just seems to be this, there's like an urgency in it in this last season, this last year and a bit, that's just so refreshing. It's like no escaping it. In Romans 10, verses 14 and 15, you don't have to turn, but the Apostle Paul is—he's having a good one, and he says this: "How then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard?" And he goes on to say, "And how can they hear without someone preaching it to them? And how can they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news." It had been a long day at the office, full of deadlines and meetings that leave editors eager for only one thing, getting home and relaxing with their families. As John Jennings, not his real name, navigated across the freeway system towards his suburban home, he fell into prayer, a habit he had developed to redeem the hours spent in traffic jams. He interceded for his family, his co-workers, and his friends. He prayed about an article he was writing. Then he began again asking God to provide opportunities for personal evangelism. Suddenly, strange thoughts entered his mind, as well as the accompanying peace, indicating the Lord was responding to his prayers. He had acted on these kind of impulses and thoughts before, almost always seeing God work through him. God told John to stop at a familiar restaurant, look for a certain waitress, and tell her that God had something for her. Further, God said that what he had for the waitress would only be revealed when John talked to her. Though apprehensive, John responded to the instruction, steering his car towards the restaurant. He did so because he sensed that God had arranged a divine appointment. A divine appointment is an appointed time in which God reveals himself to an individual or group through spiritual gifts or other supernatural phenomena. God arranges these encounters. They are meetings he has ordained to demonstrate his kingdom. After being seated in the waitress's section, John began to ponder all the reasons for not delivering the message. While he was caught up in anxious thoughts, she walked straight up to his table, and before he could get a word out, she said, "You have something for me, don't you?" In response, his hesitance was now completely gone. He told her that God had sent him specifically with something, and then two insights regarding her job and a relationship, both areas of trouble for her, were supernaturally revealed to him. Asking God for courage, he told her. She was stunned. She knew that she was encountering God, because the only way John could have known the things that he told her was through supernatural means. In Scripture, this is called a word of knowledge or message of knowledge. You can see that in 1 Corinthians 12, verse 8. At the end of the conversation, they prayed. She wept and wept. Later, John learned that she was the daughter of a Christian pastor who was now dead, and that she had turned away from God soon after the divine appointment. She gave her heart to God. Divine appointments are an integral part of evangelism. People who would otherwise resist hearing the gospel instantly open to God's word. Sometimes even the most hostile individuals turn to God when a significant need is met. How then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. This leads us nicely into the next image, and the next image, the word I want to look at is the word mountains. And I think it's important to at least give the word mountains a couple of minutes here, because Our verse doesn't read, "How beautiful on the warm white sand." Our verse doesn't read, "How beautiful on the straight and level path." It reads, "How beautiful on the mountains." And I'm aware, maybe at first, because of the other point I made a minute ago, it might seem like I'm pushing this to the limits. But I guess the reason why I think this is relevant, because I don't know about you, but a mountain, it's not an easy place to go for a walk. Is it really? It's not an easy place. And I started to think about that, and you know, there's the dangerous terrain, there's the extreme climates, there's the point I'm making is this, is that commitment is involved. Hard work is involved. Determination is involved. And for some mountains, even training and conditioning your body is involved. Where you've got to work with the way that you breathe and how you spend and save your energies so that you can climb at those higher atmospheres. As we move out in obedience to what God's asked us to do here in Dublin 8, as we answer the Lord's call to go in Dublin and beyond, we need to remember this and not to be put off by it and not to be disheartened. But just simply just to remember this, that sometimes bringing the good news is going to be hard to do. So it's not like we just discard it and, well, now that's not an easy thing to hear, is it? And sometimes people aren't all that comfortable hearing about it. Well, you're in church, you should be, you know, saying all the great things about evangelism. We're going to be doing that. But the thing is that sometimes it's not easy. Sometimes those time, you know, sometimes even just getting time with your friends and families that don't yet know the Lord, just in just the busyness of life, that can be a hard thing to do, and you've got to prioritize it. It always seems to be when we've had a terrible week, or we're just completely shattered since the baby's come, and you know, it's then that my family rings up and says, "Do you want to come for dinner?" And it's the last thing I want to do. It's the last thing I want to do. But it's been those situations and just obedience in those times and places where, you know, one of them will speak up or ask a question or... So I'm not necessarily saying this to put anybody off, but I'm just wanting to kind of like just kind of say it as it is. Keeping in mind that, you know, this passage about feet, it's to encourage every one of you, because you all have feet, you know, the whole image is there for us to realize this call to bring good news, this call to be on the mountain, it's to you all. It's to you all. William Carey, he's a well-known Baptist missionary. He's passed away now a long time. He had this great motto, I love it. Expect great things from God and attempt great things for God. Isn't that great? Expect great things from God and attempt great things for God. The most incredible thing about this one verse that we're looking at this morning in verse 7 is that God doesn't say, Isaiah, this is cool when this happens. He doesn't say, you know what, it's all right, you know. He looks at, with his image of feet that he speaks, with his image of the mountain, he says, it's beautiful. It's almost like a, I'm not saying it doesn't work, but at first it seems like, wow, does that really fit, Lord? Is that what you want to say? Are you sure, Lord? as we fumble around, as we try our hardest, and he thinks it's beautiful when we just give it a shot. Like the man in that story, just going on a hunch, just pulling off the freeway and going to somewhere where you've had dinner before. When you see somebody at a bus stop and the Lord just gives you a sense of where their heart is at, and you kind of go up and you go, I don't know, I'm a Christian, and well, that's just the way I do it. But the thing is that, you know, he thinks it's beautiful. And when he sees our attempts, and he sees our willingness to, even in the kind of when it feels like it's just all over the place, he just loves to see that. Okay, moving on to our next section. Going to look together at these three pieces: who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, and proclaim salvation. The word proclaim, I spent a little bit of time and looked this up, and it's quite punishing. The word used here means to declare publicly, insistently, proudly, defiantly, in speech or in writing, to announce and to show and give outward indication of. That's my favorite part. What does that look like? Outward indication. Sorry. Let me just say that again. The word for proclaim, to declare publicly, insistently, defiantly, proudly, in speech or writing, to announce and to show and give outward indication of. Outward indication. This is the spirit that we're called to go. We're called to go in. Or in this case, to bring the good news of Jesus in. So let's look first at the word peace. The word used for peace here means a state of security, or order within a community, and freedom from oppressive thoughts or emotions. We are called to proclaim God's promise and provision of peace publicly, insistently, proudly, defiantly, in speech or writing, to announce and to show and give outward indication of. I was blown away. We were at absolute slap-up meal tonight in Bevan Wilson's last night. It was brilliant. And we had... about a week and a bit ago, we had watched our neighbour's 7-year-old, Jordan, and they were at a wedding, and we took her for the night. I was kind of like I was a bit freaked out because it kind of gave me my first taste of what it's going to be like to have three girls running around. So I was kind of like a little freaked out by it. But she said, "Listen, I just want to do the same for you. I just want to, you know, I'll just if you need me." And Beck said, "Well, actually, we can't find a babysitter to go out on Saturday night. Would you come down?" So she came down, and we came home last night, and she was 88 pages into a book on the Lord that she had found on the shelf. She's that hungry. She's leading herself. I mean, we've had a couple of opportunities to pray with her and to share about what we about the Lord and what we do with our lives, but she's that hungry. She's that longing for the truth of the gospel, for the good news. She's that hungry for it. She's helping herself to books on a shelf in a sitting room. It's remarkable. So sometimes evangelism can just be having the right books on your shelf. But this is it's this sense of what are you laughing at, Banger? Sometimes. You know, when we look at these words like peace and good tidings and salvation, they just seem like, well, I don't know, what does that mean, Lord? But sometimes it's just as simple as just, you know, telling somebody it's going to be all right. Sometimes it's just saying, no matter what happens next,
we'll be here for you.
That conversation where I was talking to my family, my cousin, he just attempted committing suicide, and my family was distraught. I was thinking, what can I do? And I did. I prayed. I said, Lord, is there a verse I can bring to them? And all it was just say, if you want to come over, if you want to have a meal, we love you. We'll just be here for you. That when this text talks about peace, it's not like rocket science, folks. Freedom from oppressive thoughts or emotions. That's what the word peace here is when you go and look at what it means. That's what it means. Moving on, just for time's sake, good tidings. Well, good tidings in the dictionary is just described as a piece of news. Tidings is just a piece of news. And wherever we go, we're to be, announcing and showing, giving outward indication that piece of news. Even if, say, for instance, this will be maybe might be helpful. Another friend of mine really, really struggles with just getting by financially, And I said, well, I'll really pray that God provides your needs. I'll really pray that God breaks through in your finances this month. I really pray an extra lesson comes in so you can earn a little bit more for Christmas. Really, and sometimes it's just a little bit of good news. Like, wow, like God's concerned with me. Like God would, sometimes good tidings, it just can be like, do you know that God cares about your finances? That he can provide in the most incredible ways. I can remember trying to explain to him that God had given us the money for our new car, and he was like, what? You didn't get a loan. I was like, well, we had a loan, but it was paid off by somebody. He was like, what? And he was just trying to get his head around the fact that someone would come up and give what was at the time, just to give testimony to God, thousands and thousands of euros. He just couldn't get his head around it. You could see him like, golly, I mean, that's something that you could bank in on that one, Lord, But good tidings, it's just described in the dictionary as a piece of news. Just a bit of truth. To the person in your family struggling with ill health, I'll pray about that chest infection. I'll pray about the tummy bug. I'll pray about the sore leg. I'll pray about the eyesight. It's just a little bit of good news. It's like, what moved me about that reminder of the rainbow image this morning is that it's to do with promise. One of the most underestimated sentences in the Bible, in the first book, did God really say? You've made a step and you said, I'll do it, Lord. I'll trust you and I'll share my fate with my friends. And then you just have this kind of nauseous pit of your stomach. I don't really know if you've got that gift. I don't really, and now sometimes we think and we interpret that as us kind of like, rationalizing, well, I don't want to, if I'm not gifted at it, I don't want to make an idiot of myself. But, I mean, I do constantly. I would say every time I've shared my faith with my family and friends, I've done it the wrong way. The way I just see, the way I look at it, I just kind of go, well, I've been doing it. I've been making attempts. And then bit by bit, it gets a little bit easier. Bit by bit, we become a little bit more sensitive. God willing. So the last of these three is salvation. Of the many Hebrew words used to signify salvation, the word used here in verse 7 is said yasa, Y-A-S-A. To save, and interpreted, that means to save, help in distress, rescue, deliver, and set free. And that's the word to describe salvation that appears mostly in the Old Testament. But that's not the end of the story, is it? When we talk about salvation in the New Testament, the name Emmanuel, God with us, signifies a momentous progression. in the history of salvation. In Matthew's gospel, the angel tells Joseph that Mary's child is conceived of the Holy Spirit and that he is to give him the name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. Matthew 1 verses 21 to 23, you'll find that. The name Jesus is derived from the Hebrew Joshua, which itself means salvation. The purpose for the Son of Man's coming is to seek out and save the lost. You'll find that in Luke 19 verse 10. The New Testament, I love this, the New Testament continues the Old Testament affirmation that salvation belongs to God alone. But more specifically, that God's presence in and through the man Jesus brings about true salvation. So that's the truth. That's the salvation that we're to be declaring, proclaiming publicly, insistently, proudly, defiantly, in speech or in writing, to announce and to show and give outward indication of. Okay, our last point. Who say to Zion, your God reigns. Just to read a little helpful piece of history I found in a book I was reading about this. Zion was originally a geographical term used to describe the city of David and Jerusalem. But with the extension of the city to incorporate where they built the temple, Zion became a name that signified the dwelling place of God. And there's a great psalm that you can read, Psalm 9 verse 11, and it says this, "Sing praises to the Lord enthroned in Zion." But the book went on to say this, the name Zion is seldom used in historical passages, but it occurs frequently in poetic and prophetic compositions as a description for all of Jerusalem. In time, Zion took on figurative as well as geographical connotations. Jerusalem is called the daughter of Zion in Isaiah 1 verse 8 and the virgin daughter of Zion in 2 Kings 19. Jerusalem's inhabitants are called the sons of Zion in Lamentations 4, the woman of Zion in Isaiah 3:16, and the elders of the daughter of Zion in Lamentations 2:10. In these expressions, the city has been personified. The extension of a place name to refer to its inhabitants recognizes that the character of a city is determined more by the traits of its population than by its buildings. I found that was just a helpful thing, but not immediately conclusive. So when this text says that we are to proclaim, considering everything that I've just said, that this good news, this good tidings, this peace, this salvation, who are we to be speaking this to? Who say to Zion? Well, if you want to go to in finishing, Revelation 21, verses 1 to 4. We're just going to look at that as we finish now. And you can follow, I'm going to confuse things and read from the Message translation. And there you should see a paragraph entitled The New Jerusalem. Is that what's there? What page is it? Okay, Eugene Peterson, he calls his paragraph Everything New. I saw heaven and earth new created, gone the first heaven, gone the first earth, and gone the sea. I saw holy Jerusalem new created, descending out of heaven, as ready for God as a bride for her husband. I heard a voice thunder from the throne, "Look! Look, God has moved into the neighborhood, making his home with men and women. They're his people, he's their God. He'll wipe every tear from their eyes. Death is gone for good. Tears gone, crying gone, pain gone. All the first order of things gone. We are to proclaim publicly, insistently, proudly, defiantly, in speech or writing, to announce and to show and give outward indication of. You kind of get a sense, I like that. But what we are to proclaim the promise and provision of God's peace, good tidings and salvation to Zion, to men and women everywhere. They're His people, He's their God. Let's stand together.